Welcome to FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. I'm Nate Kazmarek, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federal Society. For exclusive access to live recordings of FedSoc Forum programs, become a Federal Society member today at fedsoc.org.
Hello, welcome to this FedSoc Forum webinar call. Today, February 17th, 2026, we are delighted to host this discussion on the FTC's 2026 Consumer Protection Priorities. My name is Matthew Sautel, and I'm Assistant Director of Practice Groups at the Federal Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call, as the Federal Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. In the interest of time, we'll keep the introductions brief, but if you'd like to know more about any of our panelists, you can access their full bios at fedsoc.org. Today, we are fortunate to have Brian Bergren, Svetlana Gans, and Professor Todd Sawicki as our speakers, and Ashish Agarwal as our moderator. Mr. Agarwal is an alumnus of the FTC, and he's currently a consultant on competition issues for the U.S. Chamber of Commerce and other organizations. One last note, throughout the panel, if you have any questions, please submit them through the question and answer feature in Zoom so that we'll have access to them when we get to that portion of the webinar. We do ask that questions submitted there both pertain to this discussion and end with a question mark. With that, thank you for being with us today. Ashish, the floor is yours.
Well, thank you, Matt, and thank you very much to the Federal Society for putting together this panel. We're here today to discuss the FTC's approach to consumer protection issues, an issue that has taken on even greater importance in the national economy. Under new leadership and following a series of executive orders, including the President's AI Action Plan, the FTC is now requiring actual evidence of consumer harm in its enforcement actions. This means a renewed focus on bread and butter enforcement issues, while also working to ensure that the U.S. remains the global leader in technological innovation. Today, we have an outstanding panel to discuss the FTC's approach to these issues. First up, we have Brian Bergren, who is the Acting Associate Director of the Bureau of Consumer Protection's Division of Enforcement. Brian oversees a broad portfolio that includes the Made in the USA program, the Restore Online Shoppers Confidence Act, ROSCA, and the agency's crackdown on systemic fraud. Next, we have Svetlana Gans. Svetlana is a partner at Gibson Dunn and one of the nation's foremost experts on consumer protection and privacy. Svetlana served at the FTC in multiple roles for over a decade, most recently as chief of staff in Trump One. She herself chairs the Federal Society's Antitrust and Consumer Protection Executive Committee. Finally, we have Todd Sawicki. Todd is a professor at the Scalia Law School and former head of its Law and Economics Center. Among his prior roles, Todd chaired the CFPB's Task Force on Federal Consumer Financial Law and served as the director of the FTC's Office of Policy Planning. And as Matt mentioned, I'm your moderator, Ashish Agarwal. I do lots of consulting work for the U.S. Chamber and others. And I should note that the Chamber has launched a Consumer Policy Council to explore these consumer protection issues further, given their importance to the economy. Well, Brian, let's start with you. Can you give us an overview of the FTC's work? In particular, how has the FTC's consumer protection enforcement changed from the prior administration? What were some of the highlights of last year, and what can we expect going forward?
Well, thank you for having me today and for inviting me to speak about the FTC's consumer protection work. And so before I start, I need to give a brief disclaimer. The views I express today are my own. They do not necessarily reflect the views of the FTC, the commissioners, or the Bureau of the Consumer Protection. And so I'll start first by addressing some of the FTC's priorities, along with some of the highlights from this past year. And then after that, I'll address how enforcement efforts have changed under this administration, with a particular emphasis on consent orders. So in terms of priorities, the FTC is committed to vigorously enforcing the laws that Congress has empowered us to enforce. And so our renewed focus here is on rigor. We're ensuring that we are hewing to the plain language of the statute and acting only where the evidence supports our action. And at the beginning of 2025, the chairman and Director Mafarage indicated a renewed focus on enforcing what are called black letter consumer protection laws. So think of Section 5 deception, COPPA, ROSCA, the telemarketing sales rule, the FCRA, the impersonation rule, and many others. And when it comes to unfairness, we will use our authority, for example, where we can prove each element of 45N. In terms of specific enforcement areas, there have been many over this past year. We've seen aggressive enforcement when it comes to bread and butter fraud. These would be false or deceptive earnings claims, business opportunity scams, impersonation scams, debt relief scams. The second area is protecting children online. The third area is addressing deceptive subscription enrollment and billing cancellation practices. And the fourth is unlawful ticketing practices under the fees rule and the bots act. And so I'll now turn to some of the highlights over this past year. And so the FTC has brought dozens of enforcement actions to advance these priorities and frankly more. And I'll highlight just two areas to help frame our discussion today. The first is going to be unlawful subscription practices. The FTC has prioritized action against unlawful subscription billing and cancellation practices. These are issues that quietly drain households' budgets. Under the direction of the chairman, the FTC is vigorously enforcing Section 5 of the FTC Act and ROSCA, which requires clear disclosures, express informed consent, and simple cancellation mechanisms. Over this past year, the FTC has filed litigation against Uber over its Uber One subscription, LA Fitness for making it difficult for consumers to cancel their gym memberships, and referred an action against Iconic Hearts to the DOJ due to the company's enrollment and cancellation practices. We've also settled multiple enforcement actions that obtained significant redress for consumers, namely the action against Match, Instacart, Chegg, and Clio AI. The FTC has also obtained a historic settlement in the Amazon Prime ROSCA litigation on the third day of trial. We secured a $1 billion civil penalty, which is the largest civil penalty in a rule violation type case, and a $1.5 billion consumer redress fund, the second largest redress award in the agency's history. The second area is protecting children online, and this has been and will continue to be one of the commission's highest priorities. Over the past year, the FTC took action against the operator of the Send It anonymous messaging app for allegedly unlawful collection of personal information from children. The company failed to notify parents and obtain their consent. And the FTC also took action against Disney for misdesignations of content on YouTube that allegedly resulted in YouTube collecting personal information from children without parental notice or consent. And finally, I want to briefly address some of the changes to how the FTC approaches enforcement, and in particular, consent agreements under this administration. As the chairman and bureau director have remarked before, the prior administration sought novel remedies, including relief not directly tied to the alleged conduct, monetary judgments not based on sound economic analysis, and one-size-fits-all injunctive provisions in 20-year orders. Under the chairman's leadership, the FTC is taking a different approach. For starters, we've prioritized returning money back to consumers, such as in the case of a rule violation. But to be clear, we'll seek civil penalties when they're supported by the facts or law. We're also reducing the length of orders where appropriate and where warranted by the facts. So, for example, the agency has included a 10-year sunset provision in the Amazon ROSCA litigation settlement and the Instacart settlement. In other settlements, the FTC has included sunsets for specific affirmative conduct provisions, like the 3-year TSR compliance provision in the Dun & Bradstreet settlement. But to be clear, if you're engaging in fraudulent schemes, we'll continue to seek strong permanent injunctive provisions in federal court. And finally, the FTC is now attempting to avoid a one-size-fits-all approach in consent orders. Likewise, our orders should not lock companies into using outdated practices, particularly when we're dealing with nascent industries or areas where we expect rapid technological change.
Brian, that is really helpful. Thank you. Can you tell us one thing about the FTC that you wish was better known or understood?
Yeah, I think one thing that comes to mind is something the Bureau Director Chris Mafarage mentioned in a speech about 3 weeks ago. But the FTC intends to seek monetary judgments that are supported by sound economic analysis and theories. And one area where this has become more apparent is during consent negotiations. Staff are not going to hide the ball. They're when it comes to our harm calculations in particular, and we're going to be more transparent. We're going to share economic theories and analysis. But to be clear, the street goes both ways. This means that companies and targets need to provide information to staff during the investigative phase so that we can consider it before entering consent.
That's excellent. So, Lana, let's turn to you. Now, your practice focuses heavily on FTC litigation and rulemaking and investigations. What differences have you noticed from the prior regime to the Trump administration? And what would you like to see the FTC focus on?
Thanks so much, Ashish, and glad to be on a panel with Brian and Todd. Great to see them both. So I would echo all of Brian's remarks. I think the Trump 2 FTC has done all of those things and really has made it easier for the FTC to use its limited resources to get historic gains for the public, but also has made it easier for law-abiding companies to work with the FTC. And that all started at the inception of the transition where the FTC kind of reinstituted the normal processes and the normal protocols of the FTC. It changed the strategic plan to ensure that FTC's processes would not be burdening legitimate business activity. And it also restored the faith, I believe, in the regulated entities that they know now that they have an open door policy at the FTC and that things are not really hidden in terms of the process. So in terms of what's different between now and before, I think respondents are getting due process at the agencies. They are speaking with staff and management and the commissioners. Those steps are all included in either litigation discussions or settlement negotiations or CID negotiations. I think that the FTC has tried to narrow some of the investigational burdens imposed on parties. And there has also been more transparency in terms of the calculation of monetary remedies as well as the legal theories pursued. I would also echo Brian's remarks about the FTC trying to stay in its lane in terms of its statutory authority. There's been definitely a focus on concrete consumer harm and violations of black letter laws and not so much the focus on speculative harms that I believe were pursued to a great extent in the earlier administration and the Biden administration. So I think that there has been great work done so far in terms of areas where I think could be maybe focused on in the next year is more transparency around the calculation of monetary remedies. I appreciate staff and the Bureau of Economics have been more forthcoming with respect to damages calculations. I like to see some type of policy or some additional transparency around the calculation of consumer harm and redress. And I like to see the agency focus more on regulatory reform. As we'll talk about later, the FTC does have several rules that it's working on, but there are also some rules that the FTC could potentially narrow or make less burdensome in light of the technological changes.
Thanks, Lana. Todd, I want to pick up on something Lana said about a change in the FTC's approach to litigation, which is there seems to be an emphasis now on, litigating where there is, evidence of actual consumer harm as compared to the prior administration, where it was a little more of a nebulous unfairness standard. Is that consistent with your view? And what do you think that means for the FTC going forward and consumers?
Absolutely. I think this is perhaps the most important thing. And as the gray beard professor on the panel, what's going on reminds me a lot of the 1980s following the wild and woolly FTC of the 1970s, where they're kind of off the rails, pursuing all kinds of crazy theories. They were going to ban the advertising and children's television as unfair on these very speculative novel type harms. And what happened in the 1980s was, when Reagan came in and the FTC came in and kind of brought the agency back to its senses. And for example, that was where we saw the unfairness policy statement that later became the statutory guide for unfairness, requiring substantial injury to consumers and the like. And I think basically what we've seen the last few years is they just basically ignored the statute. They were coming up with speculative harms. The kind of cost benefit type analysis they were having was sort of laughable. If you look at like the CARS rule, for example, just completely made up joke of numbers sort of stuff. And so I think, in enforcement, the same way. Right. And so I think, you know, what we're seeing, and a lot of it was politically driven. A lot of the enforcement actions look politically driven. But the actions that Brian talks about is a good example of really using the law. I mean, whether it's ROSCA or whether it's a real hard-nosed, rigorous analysis of unfairness to focus on actual concrete harms rather than speculative sort of made-up theories, using real economics rather than made up economics. And if you look at the actions that Brian described, right, the Uber One action, the LA Fitness action, the Amazon Prime action, right? These are cases, and you see these and you're like, well, duh, right? I mean, it's like you see these, they're obviously burdensome for consumers. They're not properly disclosed. I mean, these are really concrete bread and butter issues of just good old fashioned unfairness with substantial harm to consumers, with no benefit really outweighing these particular things. And if you compare that, for example, to kind of the far flung theories of junk fees and some of the other kind of made up economic theories we're going to see later on, I think they're focusing their resources on real consumer practices that truly harm consumers, and getting real redress for consumers and getting businesses to change their practices without interfering with innovation, creativity, and the things that can benefit consumers.
Well, Brian Todd just outlined the "well duh" standard for you, so you can consider that. But look, let me ask you this: you're getting a lot of love for the panel for the approach, which is great. Has the FTC's appetite for litigation, you know, changed as compared to trying to negotiate some resolutions? And how has the FTC fared in court during this administration?
Yeah, well, the FTC is not afraid to litigate cases that align with, our consumer protection priorities. And as Todd and Svetlana have said, I think the difference is we're really using longstanding principles underpinning our authority. And so the first thing we do, it's got to start with the plain language of the statute. Then we look for evidence of consumer harm. And then we want to have strong facts. To Todd's point, it's almost like, well, duh, that is what we want, you know, the outcome to be when we file a lawsuit. And look, we've been successful in defeating motions at the pleading stage and at summary judgment. I mean, the Amazon Prime litigation, we settled in September, but we won a partial summary judgment motion on ROSCA. We defeated contested Daubert motions. We excluded important evidence from trial. And then the agency dedicated significant staff and resources in that matter so the team could be successful against a well-funded defendant. But even today, we have over a dozen active litigations. Several of those are against large companies, Uber, Ticketmaster, LA Fitness. We've partnered with states to obtain consumer relief and redress. And so I think we're being more successful in litigation and by selectively choosing what cases we need to litigate as opposed to settle.
All right. Well, that's great. So let's turn to rulemaking. And Todd, I'd like to start with you. How has the FTC's approach to rulemaking, in your view, how has the FTC's approach to rulemaking changed in this administration? And what would you like to see in the next coming year?
Yeah, I think it's a lot of the same thing. I think one of the things that people might have been expecting was that, that the Trump administration has come in and basically shut down the Bureau of Consumer Protection, immediately start trying to repeal all the regulations were passed and that sort of thing. And I think what we're seeing is that's not true. I think what we're seeing is consistent with the enforcement policy, which is having an FTC that's focused on particular consumer harms and creating rules where rules should be kept, amending them where they need, amending them otherwise, and moving to repeal them otherwise. And I think two good examples are the ones that Brian gave, which I love these cases, right? The tickets cases, the short term, hotels, the hidden fees rules, right? I've written on this. I've spoken on this. These are tangible harms, right? And the fact that they did not come in and just try to, slash and burn on these sorts of things, but actually taking these rules and applying them and putting some teeth on them in a rigorous sort of way, rather than just sort of free floating theories of junk fees that made no sense, right? That were, completely justified fees in terms of cost for consumers, or focusing on the wrong thing, like, the element of the cars rule, where they focus on nitrogen filled tires as an upcharge, when in fact the tires themselves are the bogus part, right? But all these things that were just sort of really poorly reasoned applications of the rules. And so I think what we're seeing here is a really nuanced approach to this, picking and choosing with a lot of sense and a lot of thought as to what rules should be kept, how they can be structured in a way that will benefit consumers, what rules should be allowed to die, and things like that.
Well, on that point, Svetlana, a question for you. As you know, the president has issued an executive order regarding the ratio of new rules to rules that should be deleted. Could you talk a little bit about what that order says, and then what does that mean for any new rulemakings coming out of the FTC and the sort of scrutiny that we can expect from OIRA?
Yeah, thanks for that question. I, like Todd, am kind of a geek on FTC rulemaking. I think, there's two executive orders of issue, two main ones. One is the 10-for-1 rule, that executive order that I don't think applies in 2026. But there's also another executive order that mandates that all independent agency rules go through a OIRA review. And that's something new that the FTC hasn't historically done previously. So OIRA will conduct a cost-benefit analysis, as is required under the FTC Magnuson-Moss process, which is a bit distinct and more cumbersome than the APA process that other agencies are subject to. But going on to Todd's point, I think the FTC could be doing a bit more in terms of streamlining existing regulations. No one wants to see good consumer protection rules go to the wayside, but given that some of these rules are decades old, you can maintain the premise of the rule, but just make it more up to date in terms of innovating on compliance availabilities and different ways of complying with the rules based on the internet age and so forth. I would agree with Todd that the FTC should be taking a nuanced approach to rulemaking and following sense and thought. I think there's two big issues there. One is really identifying the prevalent unfair deceptive practices that are an issue. I'm a bit concerned to see the FTC notify OIRA about a potential new negative option rulemaking, and I think we'll discuss that in more detail later. I think economy-wide rules should be thought about really carefully before proceeding, because it is difficult for the FTC to craft economy-wide rules given the Section 18 requirements. And also, ensuring that the FTC follows the procedures that are in place under the FTC requirements. For example, both the CARS rule and the click to cancel rule that were finally promulgated in the Biden administration, they all were withdrawn because of procedural issues including the quick to cancel rule, where the Biden administration failed to follow the Section 18 requirements to have a preliminary regulatory analysis. So I do think sector specific rules could be a good idea if they're prevalent practices shown, but I caution the FTC to proceed cautiously with respect to economy-wide rules and really ascertain whether or not a rule is the way to go, or should the agency rather spend its resources on case-by-case enforcement like they're doing so robustly under ROSCA.
Yeah, Brian, welcome your thoughts on anything Todd and Svetlana just had to say. And we will get a little more in the weeds on negative option rule in a moment. But writ large, is the FTC considering, you know, streamlining or rescinding any existing rules?
Well, look, I can't comment at this point on any open rulemaking, but I think the agency's regulatory goals are to refocus on legally and empirically justified rulemaking. And I think that starts with, you know, analyzing whether rules still continue to serve consumers and whether they are imposing unwanted and undue burden on business. But I will say, I think the, you know, agency's rulemaking agenda is slowly taking shape. The chairman announced that the FTC will be launching this rulemaking in unfair or deceptive fees in the rental housing industry. And that was in the Graystar statement that he issued. And then, you know, the FTC announced in late January that we sent the ANPR for that rulemaking to OMB and OIRA for their review. And as Svetlana mentioned, we also sent an ANPR for potential amendments to the negative option rule to OIRA around that same time. And so this is more of a, you know, probably a stay tuned to see what's coming.
Well, thanks, Brian. Let's stick with you for a moment as we pivot to talk about agency investigations. As you know, the prior administration was criticized very heavily by many for overly burdening companies with civil investigator demands, CIDs that were very extensive. Under this administration, have you changed your approach at all to CIDs with respect to investigations? And have you started to review any existing consent orders to see if they are consistent with this administration's agenda?
Yeah. And so let's start with CIDs. And so I think one thing that the FTC is doing right now is being more thoughtful when it comes to issuing CIDs. So what we're trying to do is we're trying to balance the need for information to assess a potential law violation with the, you know, burden or the undue burden on business. And frankly, at the end of the day, we're looking for cooperation. We want to avoid judicial intervention. Now, to be clear, some burden is always expected for businesses. But what's different under this bureau and at the agency is how we address those burdens right now. And so consistent with kind of the bureau director's blog about CIDs from last March, we attempt to best burden by prioritizing certain specifications. We're agreeing to rolling productions. We're negotiating over relevant custodians. But, you know, at the end of the day, it's not an invitation to delay. It's an invitation for cooperation.
That's great. So, Lana, Todd, what have been your experiences with your clients in these areas?
I would agree with Brian. For the most part, the CIDs that we're seeing come out of the agency now have been a bit more streamlined. There are some CIDs that are still a bit too broad, in my humble opinion, but the staff have been willing to work with parties on rolling productions and narrowing the specifications where warranted. But, you know, as Brian mentioned, Director Mavarge, you know, has indicated that the agency is willing to work with parties, but the parties have to work cooperatively with the agency. So it is a two-way street, and that parties can't necessarily expect that CIDs will be easy, but given the law enforcement purpose. But we have seen the staff and the Bureau work with us more regularly in terms of negotiations of CID.
Todd, thoughts here?
Yeah, I don't represent clients, but my general observation to, I think, recapitulate what Brian and Svetlana said is, you know, what I see is by requiring some evidence of or some potential evidence of substantial harm up front, you're going to have fewer CIDs because you got to have some sense that something's going on rather than just a fishing expedition, narrower document requests, and in exchange, greater compliance and faster compliance that should be able to move these cases along better. And so I think what you've got is a real strategy here that is designed to get these cases through the pipeline sooner, to not reward deep-pocketed defendants who can string things out, and to not cripple small defendants by burying them in document requests and CIDs on a sort of wide-open fishing expedition. So I think it's a really sort of sensible way to retailer CIDs, and like they said, in terms of looking for cooperation in exchange for cooperation, we're going to not bring about the frivolous CID requests and that sort of thing. I do think that, they are still using CIDs in appropriate cases to gather information. I think the announcement of the CIDs on the deceptive health claims related to transgender treatments and that sort of thing, I think is a totally appropriate use of that power. They've clearly got enough evidence that of deception and possible other harms there that I think, that's an example of one that where there has been a lot of scrutiny. And I think that they're conducting that investigation in a pretty rigorous and proper way to get to what's going on in there. So I think it's an example of using the process in a new application of a traditional area of deceptive health claims that the FTC has a long tradition in.
Well, that's great. Let's start diving into a couple of specific issues now. I'd like to start with artificial intelligence. Brian, as you know, the president's AI action plan states that the FTC should review its orders and investigations to, quote, ensure that they do not advance theories of liability that unduly burden AI innovation, close quote. How has the FTC implemented this directive, and how should it balance its consumer protection mandate with the goal of not strangling nascent technologies, which is something that Chairman Ferguson himself has stated?
Yeah, I'll give you one clear example. So in December, the FTC reopened and set aside a 2024 consent order with a company called Rider LLC. And so that case was based on allegations that the company's AI-enabled writing assistance service could help subscribers generate false and deceptive online reviews in violation of the FTC Act. The problem, as the chairman put it, was that we were condemning a new technology simply because it might potentially be used in a problematic way. And so the final consent order, among other conditions, banned Rider from providing any AI-enabled service generating consumer or customer reviews or testimonials. And so in response to the president's AI action plan, the FTC reviewed the order and determined that the alleged facts were not enough to support a Section 5 violation. And because of the burdens imposed to AI innovation, it was in the public interest to set aside the order. And so overall, I think what you see from the agency right now is that instead of burdening AI innovation, the FTC is focused on promoting it. We do so by targeting fraud and other tangible consumer harm that may undermine consumer confidence in AI. And so the commission will continue to hold bad actors to account when they break the law using AI, such as when they deceive consumers about what generative AI can do. But we're going to do so within the bounds of our legal authority and without burdening this nascent industry in ways that our statutory authorities do not permit.
So, Lana, what advice would you have for the FTC? I mean, how can the FTC address the rise of, AI-generated consumer reviews? And you do have things like, deep fake-driven impersonation fraud. Addressing that without creating a regulatory regime that requires platforms to engage in, de facto content moderation.
Thanks, Ashish. I think in terms of FTC in particular, the FTC has moved away from initiating or continuing investigations where the alleged harm concerned AI that was very speculative. It was just the fear of AI itself. And, you know, the Biden administration, which took a more regulatory approach to AI generally, just for purposes of unfairness and what could potentially happen. This administration is still pursuing AI investigations, but focused more on whether there are claims concerning AI functionality or capabilities that are deceptive. So rather than focus more on the unfairness prong, they are looking at it from a deception lens. There are also several studies FTC is pursuing, like the 6B study concerning AI chatbots, that I'm particularly interested in seeing what happens there, because it is a very important issue, you know, as a parent, especially child-related AI chatbot assistance. In terms of the interplay between deep fakes and content moderation. I mean, I think this is a topic for a larger discussion. We could probably spend a whole hour just talking about the policy implications of this. I know the FTC has promulgated several rules, including the impersonation rule and the reviews rule that targets some of this conduct, and obviously recently issued warning letters with respect to the U.S. Take It Down Act passed by Congress. But I think this subject really warrants additional conversation and thought as to what do you do when deepfakes are online, and how do you ensure that there is, you know, kind of striking the right balance between innovation and consumer protection. There have been many proposals taken so far or identified so far, including total bans of synthetic content to more promulgation and creation of policies that some industry players are looking into right now that ban synthetic and manipulated media in their terms of service, and are taking steps to take down that content affirmatively and unilaterally. But I think this is a topic that should be studied and discussed further as to what the right regulatory and or enforcement approach should be.
What are your thoughts here? And what is the line between, you know, a neutral technology that could, in theory, be abused, and a technology that maybe is, you know, designed to deceive?
Yeah, this is a really difficult question. And AI, it's not just an issue here. It's an issue for data security, payment security. But if you focus on this particular, this is potentially a big problem. And coming up with it's probably not even a solution. There's just probably an effort to try to, you know, cost benefit analysis and sort of muddle our way through this, because it's probably can't be solved. Whatever the solution is, it's not what the FTC did in the original Ryder case. As you know, I think the if anybody wants to know sort of the new approach and why it's better, you can just read the order reopening and setting aside the order in the Ryder case, where they, you know, where they say, without any empirical or even qualitative evidence, the complaint asserts the service has no or de minimis legitimate use, right? Not only did they not look for any injury to consumers, they didn't even talk about substantial injury to consumers. They talked about speculative injury, that this might be misused. Well, you know, that could be the case for everything. It'd be like saying students aren't allowed to use AI because they could potentially, in some theoretical way, use it on a final exam, so they can't use it when they're studying, or they're not allowed to access AI websites or anything like that. So whatever the solution is, it's not that. For the time being, I think they've got the right principle, which is by the traditional standards. Is there harm? Is there actual substantial harm here? Is it being misused? And then I think, you know, part of this is, this isn't just a government solution. I think part of this is also going to consist of market actors using this. There's going to be, to some extent, I think, an arms race sort of between the good guys and bad guys here. You know, we've had problem of kind of spammy reviews on Amazon for a while. This could make it, or online shopping portals as well. This could make it worse. But what they were trying to do there is not going to make it better. And deceptive by design, thank God that thing is gone, because that was just the most ridiculous concept, just a completely open-ended speculative theory. Oh, and again, with no tangible harm attached to it, just sort of efforts to micromanage and redesign platforms without really conducting any of the traditional analysis of unfairness and the like. It's just kind of one of these behavioral economics concepts that gets thrown around without any meaning, just an effort, I think, to just kind of re-engineer industry without any effort to try to tie tangible consumer benefit and harm. And so I'm glad they've moved beyond that.
Definitely would have failed the test. We're going to talk about pricing and then data privacy. And then we have some excellent questions from the audience that we'll get to at the end. So turning to, you know, pricing and affordability, also issues of big national import. Todd, let's start with you and the negative option rule or so-called click to cancel. Todd, last year, as you know, the Eighth Circuit struck down the rule promulgated under former Chair Kahn. You could say that about a lot of things due to procedural defects. The FTC has now restarted the process with a new ANPRM. How should the FTC approach this issue going forward? And in particular, how should the agency adjust its prevalence and economic impact analyses to satisfy the court's requirements? Or should it?
Yeah, I mean, it sounds like I may have some disagreement with Svetlana on this, but you know, I'm not opposed in theory to this rule, right? As I said, you know, we've got these cases earlier that we discussed right at the outset, LA Fitness, Uber One, that sort of thing. You know, they're clear unfair. I mean, they're clear harm to consumers, whatever it is. There's the substantial harm that outweighs the benefits. That strikes me that you can start to identify certain patterns, right? Certain attributes. Once you've got three cases, and it's easy to imagine other similar cases where it's absolutely appropriate for a rulemaking, where you can provide guidance to the industry of doing it, right? You know, I think it's also be a lot easier rather than the sort of made up analysis that they had the last time around. Prevalence, economic impact, that sort of thing. The standards of evidence proof, economic evidence you might put for that, shouldn't be that difficult, I would think, to produce for an appropriate rulemaking that actually is tethered to the language of the law and clearly satisfies the standard, as opposed to relying on these sort of speculative and novel theories.
Well, Svetlana, definitely welcome your thoughts on Todd's take. And in particular, let me ask you this. I mean, is there a compelling need here for a rule, given how effectively the FTC has used, you know, ROSCA, the FTC Act, and other tools?
I don't think this rule is warranted. I agree with Todd. The FTC has been doing a great job, regulating within its bounds of authority under ROSCA. I think the FTC will have a hard time showing prevalence and economic evidence of harm as to the specific conduct at issue in the new proposed regulation. The harm and the prevalence have to be tied to what the new rule would want to achieve. And I think the FTC will have a hard time showing that in this case, in light of the robust enforcement success of ROSCA.
Brian, recognizing that there is an open ANPRM, is there anything you'd like to add?
Yeah. Look, I think here, Svetlana makes a good point. I disagree. I do think, you know, to figure out whether there's a compelling need for the FTC to engage in rulemaking, that's the entire purpose of the ANPR, to figure out whether there is that need and that we need to start the process and see if there are prevalent and widespread practices that need to be addressed through a formal rulemaking. I think one factor out of many will be whether the FTC's current legal authorities sufficiently cover the waterfront of kind of harmful practices to consumers. But even to that factor, I think our authority is frankly imperfect. ROSCA covers negative option transactions that are affected on the internet. There are many negative option transactions that happen online and frankly may not be covered absent a formal rulemaking.
Let's talk about pricing and the states a little bit. New York has, now a new disclosure requirement for when a price is set by an algorithm. What do we think about that rule? We also have, California and other states passing their own pricing laws. What do we think about the activity at the state level? And does that suggest a need for any type of national standard? Svetlana, let's start with you.
Yeah, I mean, it is also an interesting question. I'd be curious on Tog's take. I mean, the states have been very active right now in terms of promulgating pricing surveillance, transparency type of laws. I can't opine on that. It is very difficult to comply on a nationwide basis. So we're seeing kind of what we saw in the privacy space, where there's a patchwork of state privacy laws, and folks are calling for a national privacy scheme. And so I'm not sure if we're at the point right now that we want to see a federal pricing transparency law. That it's too soon to tell. I'd be curious in getting more details in terms of, what the conduct is that any potential rule might want to solve. And perhaps, the Congress should think through that. I really don't think it's an area that the FTC should be focused on, given that it is really a congressional issue at this point.
Todd, Brian, thoughts?
Yeah, I'm very skeptical of this whole concept of, quote, surveillance pricing, unquote. This just strikes me as dark patterns, deceptive this, junk fees, right? Just sort of clever branding designed to pretend like there's intellectual weight to something, or to something that is much more nuanced. And this is clearly an example. I mean, in all likelihood, and maybe this is why it's politically popular, in all likelihood, this is basically going to protect rich people, right? I mean, for example, there was a paper, margins of increase. There's some evidence of margins of increase in retail. But margins of increase, basically because higher income people don't shop around as much as low-income people. We got more high-income people in the economy, right? So the idea of price discovery is something we've come to be totally accept that when it comes to Uber and Lyft fares. We accept that people pay different prices for hardbacks versus paperbacks, for buying things on sale, for buying things in peculiar colors. And the idea of airlines changing flight prices, that sort of thing, right? So presumptively, this idea of what we see square code surveillance pricing, unless somebody can show me that this leads to, permanent economic rents in an economic concept, supernormal returns, then at most what we're talking about are consumer cross subsidies. And in all likelihood, what we're talking about is rich people paying more than lower income people, who are likely to be more price sensitive. And so the whole idea at this point seems pretty confused to me. There certainly needs to be something more than just scary terms and scare quotes before we go running off calling it a consumer problem without fully understanding it. And so I would say this is something that, yes, go after, so-called junk fees that are hidden from consumers, like the BOTS Act, the things we talked about earlier, ticketing fees, things where they conceal the price until the end, things that make price transparency more difficult. But that's a big cry from this, which is trying to adapt pricing in kind of real time to what consumers are shopping for.
Brian, any thoughts here, especially on this notion of a patchwork? Go ahead.
Yeah, and to kind of echo Todd's point, I think, the agency is very thoughtful about this. They've been very focused on price transparency and affordability issues. And in particular, we've focused a lot on these hidden or deceptive fees. We've focused on them in rental housing, which is the Graystar case, on delivery services, which is Instacart, auto, what people are paying for their cars, and kind of, add-ons that are unwanted. But the broader point with respect to unfairness is that, you know, the agency is really focused on deception right now. And you know, to the extent there is an unfairness claim brought, I think you have to kind of, you know, engage in a cost benefit analysis test to meet all the elements of 45N. And so that may be harder to do when you're trying to just use a loaded term like surveillance pricing or, you know, kind of surveillance advertising at the end of the day.
Well, Brian, if you don't mind, I'd like to stick with you as we pivot to yet another issue of broad national discussion, data privacy and children's safety. So, you know, as you know, protecting children, you know, remains a priority for the FTC with the Take It Down Act now in effect. How will the commission enforce platform accountability for non-consensual imagery and, you know, quote unquote, attention economy harms? And does Section 5 provide any additional tools to the agency?
Yeah. So in May, we will begin enforcing the Take It Down Act. And so that requires certain online platforms to have establish a process through which victims can report non-consensual material on the platform. And then the second requirement is kind of to take down that material and identify duplicates within 48 hours of a valid request. And so our enforcement is going to be critical here to protect kind of harms to children online. And the key is that you start with the language of the law. And the law mentions that platforms must implement a notice and removal process to address user-generated content and make reasonable efforts to remove identical known copies. And so that's what I think we're going to be looking for. You know, Section 5, of course, may provide additional benefits or additional avenues for the FTC to pursue. But the law that, you know, Take It Down Act provides them pretty clearly. And I think it's going to start with aggressive enforcement of the law instead.
Well, Lana, let's come back to the states here for a moment. You know, the states continue to pass a patchwork of privacy laws. How can or should the FTC provide a consistent federal baseline? And are we seeing a shift towards enforcing, you know, existing statutes like the COPPA Act and the FCRA rather than kind of this, you know, very broad, you know, commercial surveillance type of rulemaking?
Yeah, I would say yes. The FTC is not pursuing the commercial surveillance rulemaking or the AI rulemaking that the Biden administration had considered, which I think is a good thing. The FTC is sticking to its true colors and enforcing rules that are on the books, as Brian mentioned at the start of the hour. So we have been seeing renewed enforcement of the COPPA statute and also kind of more thought leadership. And I think that is really where the FTC can shine, moving the dialogue in terms of what are the right policy, what are the correct problems to focus on, and what are the potential policy solutions, and how can the FTC help as a convener of that dialogue. We just saw that most recently for the age gating workshop, which was quite interesting. And so I look forward to the FTC being a continued convener of national policy discussions on children's privacy issues to ascertain areas that could be, you know, either regulatorily pursued in more cases or more guidance to the industry in terms of, you know, what practices industry should partake in.
Todd, I'd like to turn to you to talk about data privacy in the context of financial information. Could you talk a little bit about the Graham-Leach-Bliley Act, what it requires, and are we seeing an uptick in enforcement there?
Yeah, this is one of, I think, the more surprising and maybe questionable initiatives by the FTC, which is this renewed use of Graham-Leach-Bliley Act. And the reason I say it's questionable is it does seem to be leveraging GLBA into some new areas where it's not obvious GLBA is designed to go, or that it's kind of the central point of what's going on. And it makes you wonder whether what's really going on here is a workaround the Supreme Court's AMG Capital decision, which limited the ability to get damages for civil penalties in these cases, whereas GLBA, by pulling it under that umbrella, allows the FTC to get damages and get at some things that are really, you know, don't necessarily seem to be what the agency is about. I won't ask Brian, but like the Graystar case, right? You know, the real problem there seems to be sort of that I think they used GLBA on that as well, is about sort of, as Brian just said, kind of hidden fees and the like. But you're able to get at it through GLBA also. And I think, you know, that is one of the areas in which sort of where this might go, I think, is highly unpredictable. And it's not quite clear what the scope of what they're trying to do here with GLBA is, to me.
Let's turn to, thanks for that, Todd. Let's turn to audience questions. I want to make sure we get to all of them in the time we have left. The first question from the audience is basically about the Humphreys executor case. So if the court were to overturn Humphreys executor, how would that affect the FTC's legitimacy and enforcement philosophy? Broad question. I will leave that open to whoever on the panel would like to take it.
Well, I'll say this is something I've thought a lot about. I don't think it'll affect that much, to tell the truth. Right now, you're basically, there are no Democrats on the panel, but on the commission. But more generally, I think the idea of independent agencies have outlived their usefulness, leaving aside the legal questions. For many years now, independent agencies have functioned exactly the same as executive agencies, in my view, right? Just by 3-2 votes. The idea was independent agencies to look for consensus. They'd be bipartisan. There'd be deliberation and the like. But for many years now, and I think really accelerated under the Biden administration, and the FTC being a good example, it was really just the exact same as any executive agency. None of that stuff was done. None of the deliberation, none of the sort of normal type things that you would have with an independent agency. So in my view, the independent agencies don't really function that way anymore. The second thing that's happened over time is they've just fundamentally become more partisan. Todd Henderson has an excellent article where he looks at the changes in the composition and the membership of independent agencies over time. And what he finds is that basically over the last 20 years, basically every independent agency now has at least one former Republican staffer and one former Democratic congressional staffer on the commission, if not more, right? And that has caused them to take on more of a partisan tinge, I think more of a political tinge than they did in the past, where you did not have that as much of a presence. So I think it's probably, Humphrey's executor may have been fine in its theory. I think there's a lot of problems. The fundamental legal problem being the FTC's powers are so much greater than it was then. But more generally, I think it'll have very little impact on legitimacy of the FTC, on how the FTC functions, or any of the other independent agencies, because I think the so-called independent agencies have essentially functioned identically to executive agencies over the last few years. And so the last thing I'll say is I'll go right back to where Svetlana started us, is it was long overdue to finally bring them under OIRA's umbrella. So I'm glad the Trump administration finally finalized that process of bringing them sort of more within the executive branch, of bringing them under OIRA's umbrella, because they were essentially executive agencies running around doing things outside of the control of the direct control of the executive branch, although I'm guessing there was a lot of informal collaboration.
Well, thanks, Todd. And we could spend the next hour talking about this, but let's get through these great questions. And Brian, if you don't mind, I'm going to direct the next one to you, which is right to repair still a priority for the commission? And there's a kind of the suggestion that we haven't heard much about right to repair from the commission recently. Go ahead.
Well, the FTC is still litigating the competition case against Deere right now. That was filed in kind of the waning days of the last administration. Right to repair is a priority. It is probably not the priority. The priorities I mentioned above, you know, at the top of the hour, I think are kind of the ones the commission's very focused on, you know, kind of, you know, the bread and butter fraud program, deceptive subscription and billing practices, protecting children online, and then also kind of these deceptive or hidden fees.
Okay, thanks. Next question, and this is for the panel. It's about the letter sent last week by the FTC to Apple regarding the content that's on Apple News. And the gist of the question is, okay, the FTC is very focused on returning to traditional legal authorities, but not necessarily clear what the basis is for those letters to Apple News. So how do you see the letters of this kind, which raise these concerns without there necessarily being a clear, legal hook for the FTC's involvement? So anyone want to tackle that? All right. Well, it's a very good question, audience member, but I don't know that our panel actually has had time to focus on that. So we'll table that for the next panel. I'm going to close with one more question, to the panel. To the extent that you think, and Todd and Svetlana, you have said very clearly that you, approve of many of the changes from the prior administration to this administration's, approach to enforcement. How do we set the FTC up for kind of long-term sustainable success, even after a change in leadership? Obviously, elections have consequences and a new administration is free to pursue its own priorities. But, given some of the just the shattering of norms under the prior administration, are there things that the FTC could do now to set itself up for long-term success? So Lana, if you don't mind, I'll start with you.
Thanks, Ashish. I think big issue right now is 13B reform. And I think working with Congress on a solution to pass 13B reform will go a long way and perhaps will restrain future commissions from creative rulemaking, which has led the agency astray for a long time. So I think that could be one important thing the FTC can do to ensure that it remains, a viable agency in the future. That would ensure it does not engage in creative rulemaking, and it will also ensure some bounds as to FTC's ability to seek monetary relief and put some guardrails around that. So I would hope that is in the works at some point soon.
Great. Todd, then Brian, you'll get the last word. Todd?
Yeah, I think one of the big things is just cultural, and I'll go back to where I started by talking about the transition from the 1970s to the 1980s. And Ashish, I know you're familiar with this history, but the FTC literally ceased to exist for a few days in the 1980s. They were so out of control in the 70s that Congress basically said enough. And for many years after that, the FTC was on year-to-year reauthorization. And I think after the excesses of the Biden administration, the FTC was kind of in a little bit of that same situation. I think that if the Supreme Court actually does overrule Humphrey's executor and just kind of finally put that out of its misery, I think that'll actually be good for the FTC. And I would contrast that with what's going on at the CFPB, which is the CFPB kind of won the battle and lost the war, in my view, by winning on the appropriations case, because they took away from Congress, and fundamentally, in the constitutional sense, the proper oversight of democratic control over the agencies. The CFPB was way out over its skis, and I think it just seemed very difficult to reform that agency, considering sort of how deeply embedded the culture was. And I'm here obviously using it in past tense, although it still exists, but in the like. So I think a lot of one of the things that the FTC could take from this is by tethering itself back to the law, tethering itself back to standard sort of rigorous economic analysis. And I think even the Supreme Court bringing it more formally under executive control, even more than the informal way that it is now, I think that can potentially bring the FTC to a more sustainable place.
Brian, you get the last word. I have to note that Todd just said it would be a good thing if your agency was found to be unconstitutional as currently constituted. Good for your agency. So that's an interesting take. But you get the last word, Brian.
No, I Todd's other points about returning to normalcy, getting back to kind of the law and the importance of economic analysis. I think those are the types of things that are kind of embedded within the agency's culture. That's why a lot of the staff are here. And, you know, that's how the agency can be set up for success in future years.
Brian Kotz-Villana, thank you very much. Thanks again to the Federalist Society. And Matt, back to you.
Thank you. On behalf of the Federalist Society, I want to thank you, our experts, for the benefit of your valuable time and expertise today. And I want to thank our audience for joining and participating. We also welcome listener feedback by email at fedsocforums@fedsoc.org. And as always, keep an eye on our website and on your emails for announcements about upcoming virtual events. Thank you all for joining us today. We are adjourned.
Thank you for listening to this episode of FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. For more information about the Federal Society, the Practice Groups, and to become a Federal Society member, please visit our website at fedsoc.org.